This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. The white Minneapolis police officer who kneeled on the neck of a handcuffed black man who later died will now be charged with second-degree murder, an upgraded charge from third-degree murder initially. The charge does not suggest premeditation but carries stiffer penalties. The documents also show that three other officers have been charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder. In a statement, the man's family, George Floyd, described the new charges as a bittersweet moment. The May 25th death of George Floyd, who has been accused of trying to buy cigarettes with a counterfeit bill, has ignited more than a week of sometimes violent protests across the United States and in major cities around the world. The 46-year-old black man died after police officer Derek Chauvin held him face down on the street and pressed a knee against his neck for almost 9 minutes. Former U.S. President Barack Obama urged every American mayor to review and reform their police department's use of force policies in consultation with their communities. The country's first black president also struck a note of optimism, even as he acknowledged the despair and anger powering the protest since Floyd's death 9 days ago, saying, "In some ways, as tragic as these last few weeks have been, as difficult and scary and uncertain as they've been, they've also been an incredible opportunity for people to be awakened to some of these underlying trends." Mr. Obama made the comments via live stream from his Chicago home in his first live remarks on the unrest that has been gripping the United States for more than a week. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Former Pentagon chief Jim Mattis has issued a stinging rebuke of his former boss, President Donald Trump, accusing the U.S. president of trying to divide America and failing to provide mature leadership as the country reels from days of protest. Mattis, who resigned in December of 2018, also voiced support for the demonstrations and demonstrators whose anti-racism rallies have roiled the country. Washington, D.C.'s National Guard is investigating the use of a helicopter as a show of force against protesters near the White House on Monday. Wednesday, Washington ordered the suspension of all flights by Chinese airlines into and out of the United States after Beijing failed to allow American carriers to resume services to China. The U.S. action takes effect June 16th, but could be implemented sooner if U.S. President Trump orders it. The move adds to a growing set of tension points between the world's two biggest economies in the aftermath of the coronavirus crisis. More than 1.8 million people in the United States are infected with COVID-19, the hardest hit country in the world, and there have been more than 107,000 deaths there so far. Worldwide, nearly 6.4 million people have been infected and more than 382,000 of them have died. Germany is headed for the worst recession in its post-war history. To that end, Chancellor Angela Merkel said her country will plunge $146 billion into a stimulus package to kickstart an economy severely hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Under the wide-ranging measures outlined in a 15-page document, value-added tax will be temporarily slashed. Families will be receiving almost $340 for each child, while those who purchase electric cars will see a government rebate doubled to $6,740. A former president of United Auto Workers faces up to 5 years in prison after pleading guilty to embezzling more than $1 million in union funds and evading taxes. Gary Jones admitted to the one count of conspiring to embezzle union dues money and conspiring to use a facility of interstate commerce to aid racketeering crimes. The 63-year-old served as a UAW president from June 2018 until resigning last December. He also pled guilty to a separate count of conspiring to defraud the United States by evading the payment of taxes on embezzled funds and filing false tax returns. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The family of Lesotho's deceased former First Lady says they want justice.
My clients and I have confidence that justice will be done. They are expecting the court to pass maximum sentence. That is to say, if possible, life sentence or death sentence.
A military shooting of civilians in South Sudan sparked protest. The Liberian Senate moves to silence a fellow senator critical of President George Weah's government. A personal protective equipment website gains popularity in South Africa. And a French court says alleged Rwanda genocide perpetrator Kabuga should be tried by a UN tribunal.
Whether Kabuga is judged in Arusha, The Hague, Rwanda or elsewhere, the important thing is that after 25 years on the run, he's arrested.
Bidere Diogini is the principal advisor for the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide in Rwanda. And a new research shows the impact of COVID-19 on marketers in Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The lawyer for the family of deceased former Lesotho First Lady, Lipolelo Tabani, says the family wants justice for her death. Kwili Ndebele says the family wants a verdict of either life imprisonment or death. Lipolelo was shot to death in her car in June 2017, just a few days before her husband, Thomas Tabani, was sworn in as prime minister. Tabani subsequently married the much younger Messiah. Messiah was charged in February this year with the murder of Lipolelo, but she immediately petitioned the acting chief justice for a bail, and within 25 minutes, it was granted. The Lesotho appeals court last week overturned the bail because of irregularities and sent it back to the high court for reconsideration. Yesterday, Wednesday, Messiah was rearrested. Kwili Ndebele is the lawyer representing the family of deceased former Lesotho First Lady Lipolelo Tabani.
The main problems that we had with that bail is that, one, it was moved hastily without giving the interested parties an opportunity to be heard. That is problem number one. Problem number two, the court was not presented with all necessary facts to enable it to do proper and judicial inquiry, as it was obliged to by the law. It did not get information regarding whether this particular person was a flight risk, whether she would not interfere with witnesses, whether she would have appeared before court at the date of hearing, whether she would attend remand. So those inquiries were not done. The bail was just arbitrarily granted. The Court of Appeal then set it aside. That is why we now have her in custody.
As you know, former Prime Minister Thomas Tabani is also allegedly said to be implicated in her death. So what does the family of the late Lipolelo Tabani want?
The family of Lipolelo Tabani is interested in seeing justice being seen done. They are interested to see those who killed their own family member facing justice. That is what they want. If the court will find those who are implicated guilty, they'll be happy. If the court does not find them guilty, fine. But what they want is justice.
Do you have confidence your client will get justice? What exactly would that justice look like?
My clients and I have confidence that justice will be done. They are expecting the court to pass maximum sentence. That is to say, if possible, a life sentence or death sentence. That is the expectation from the criminal justice system. But we still have a civil justice system which will provide compensation for the family. Those who were involved in this will have to face civil courts for damages.
Kwile Ndebele is the lawyer representing the family of deceased former Lesotho First Lady Lipolelo Tabani. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. A spokesperson for the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide in Rwanda says it doesn't matter where Felician Kabuka, the alleged perpetrator of the 1994 genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda, is tried. B. Derry Diogene, principal advisor for the commission, says what matters is that Kabuka has been arrested. A French court yesterday, Wednesday, said Kabuka should be tried by a United Nations tribunal. He is accused of financing the killing of 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in 1994.
Whether Kabuka is judged in Arusha, The Hague, Rwanda, or elsewhere, the important thing is that after 25 years on the run, he is arrested.
As you know, Mr. Kabuka has denied the allegations against him. In fact, he said he tried to stop the alleged genocide. In fact, he was helping the Tutsis. Do you think your commission or the Rwandan government has evidence to provide to the court?
The 1997 indictment, amended in April 2011, states that Kabuga is prosecuted for genocide, complicity in genocide, direct and public incitement to commit genocide, attempted genocide, conspiracy to commit genocide, crimes against humanity for persecution and extermination. Kabuga will have time to prove his innocence, but one can wonder why he hid for more than 25 years. We know that he did not surrender. He was arrested with a false identity.
I am interested in knowing how a trial of Kabuka in Rwanda would be different from his trial in Arusha or even in The Hague.
Being judged in Rwanda would facilitate the access of witnesses and the victims to the court. The evidence is easier to collect at the crime scene than elsewhere. It should also be remembered that international criminal justice intervenes very rarely. Kabuga is a Rwandan. He's prosecuted for crimes committed in Rwanda against Rwandans. Rwanda has shown its ability to try cases transferred by the mechanism for international criminal tribunal, and Kabuga is not an exception.
B. Derry Diogene is the principal advisor for the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide in Rwanda. You're speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. South Sudan's military spokesperson says two people were shot dead and several others wounded during a land dispute in Juba's Shekat neighborhood. Major General Luo Rual Kuan says the shootout was sparked by a dispute involving a senior army officer and some civilians. He says the officer has been arrested. Some Shekat residents march in the streets chanting anti-President Kiir slogans. My young David Mayar reports from Juba.
Shortly after the shooting took place in Shekat neighborhood, some residents took to the street to demonstrate. The protesters blocked the Numuli Highway, burned tires on the road, and chanted anti-Kiir administration slogans. Police and members of the South Sudan Army opened fire on the demonstrators to try to disperse the crowd. Demonstrator Juk Thiong Juk says the dispute began over a person connected to President Salva Kiir who tried to grab land from local residents.
There is a person so-called Lual Marine. Lual Marine is a cousin to the president. Lual Marine is trying to grab the land from both community citizens. And when the citizen tried to react and to reopen their businesses, Lual Marine came with the soldiers and they immediately start shooting the civilian. And in that moment, they shot dead two men and one woman, and another five are injured. And the government is silent. We are the people of this government and the government is killing us.
A statement issued by President spokesman Atenywek Ateny says, quote, the killing of five people, four men and one woman, is a very serious criminal act and the perpetrators must be punished, end quote. The statement identifies the suspect as Lualako Walkir, a distant cousin of President Kiir. It said the perpetrator was apprehended by authorities and has been transported to a nearby hospital where he is listed in critical condition. It is unclear whether he was injured during the incident or after his arrest. South Sudan Army spokesman Major General Lurwai Kong confirms the fighting started in what appears to be a land dispute between a senior army officer identified as Lual Marine and civilians at Shirkat neighborhood.
The information I received is indicating that there was a misunderstanding between one of our officers at Shirkat, and I briefly got out of hand. And as a result, from shooting issues between him and his bodyguard on one hand and civilians on the other. The information I'm having at my desk is saying two were shot dead and a few were wounded.
South Sudan in Focus saw two bodies, including an old man in Shirkat. The other body was that of a young woman who makes and sells tea at Shirkat Bus Park. Kong identified the army officer involved in the shooting as Lieutenant Colonel Lual Marine. Kong says security officers arrested Marine and are looking for his bodyguards who are still at large. Major General Daniel Justin, a spokesman for the South Sudan National Police Service, confirms the shootings took place and says police are working to restore calm in the area.
We are still at the crime scene here. We have not even known the investigation yet, but maybe after some time. Also, there are some people wounded, but still, they have rushed to the hospital. We have not finished with them to know exactly their number and so on.
Police and members of the South Sudan Army can be seen using live bullets to disperse demonstrators. Grang Abraham is a demonstrator who saw another demonstrator shot by the police.
We were coming together and he got shot by a policeman. He's wounded here on the leg. Okay. He was shot on the thighs here. From inside.
That demonstrator was left bleeding in the street and later died, which angered the crowd even more, according to Abraham. The Numili Highway, a critical route in and out of Juba, remains closed. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 4th. A Liberian senator and critic of President George Weah's administration is under investigation by his peers after calling his fellow senator spineless and rotten. The Senate reached a decision yesterday, Wednesday, authorizing a special committee to question Senator Darius Dalan of the opposition Liberty Party about his statement. Moses Gaziewu reports from Monrovia.
This Senate is rotten, it is meaningless, it is useless, and sometimes spineless in majority of people.
That was Senator Dalan with his comment about his fellow senators. But Senator Josh Tengwa took issue with the statement, saying it tarnishes the high-end reputation of members of the Senate. However, eight of the other senators called for quashing the matter for lack of consensus. But Senator Tengwa urged his colleagues to proceed with investigating Senator Dalan by the plenary.
The Senate is referred to as the House of Elders, meaning that all of us there should behave maturely, we should be well-disciplined. While our colleague surprisingly walked out of the chamber, referred to the Senate as spineless, useless, the rotting Senate.
There is fear that if found guilty, Senator Dalan might face expulsion from the Senate for tarnishing the reputation of the senators. However, Senator Tengwa told the VOA he wants Senator Dalan to apologize.
They preempt that the fellow, there are plans to expel this colleague, and no one is thinking in that direction. He should apologize to his colleagues for what he did. Right. Just an apology that shows respect.
A special committee comprising a majority of the Senate leadership will probe Mr. Dalan for a period of 1 week before reverting to plenary for further action. Senate Rule 23 states that a senator might be suspended or expelled when a petition signed by 2/3 of the membership of the Senate is forwarded to the plenary for consideration. Senator Stephen Zago is chair of the opposition Liberty Party, same as Senator Dalan. He says the action against Senator Dalan is politically motivated and intended to silence his critical voice.
They want to silence the opposition in the Senate. They've become the real that Liberty Party is becoming strong in the Senate. We got four strong senators. So if one of our nearest who comes in with a lot of reflexive, who comes with a lot of exuberance. If you silence him, you know what you're going to do? You're going to silence all the young persons out there who will be aspiring to come in the House of Legislature.
Senator Sandra Johnson of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change sided with the eight senators defending Mr. Dillon, saying the call for an investigation has no merit.
This has happened before, it is happening now, it will happen again. And I view that as a mere wish hunt and an attempt to silence critical voice in our society, and this is wrong. From the day before coming to the Senate, that has been Darius Dillon. And so it's a critical voice, and maybe there are people in other places in government who fear that. And so they believe that maybe by this could silence him. Mind you, Dillon is a political celebrity in Mosorado County. It's now extending beyond Mosorado.
Senator Dillon, who was elected in 2019, has been a strong critic of President Weah's government. Last month, Senator Dillon accused all senators who signed the Senate resolution containing the COVID-19 recast budget and other fiscal measures as spineless and rotten for accepting bribes. Moses Gazil for VOA Daybreak Africa, Monrovia.
A website that connects people wanting personal protective equipment to those selling it is gaining popularity in South Africa. Insupply.co.za was built by a self-taught web developer and software engineer at the beginning of May and has already registered more than 500 suppliers and 200 buyers. Journalist Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Tamersh Klaas understands this isn't online shopping for nice-to-haves. It's do-or-die time. He says COVID-19 has forced ordinary workplaces like offices to join hospitals in pursuing masks, gloves, sanitizers and the like. Klaas says the usual PPE supply chain just hasn't been able to cope with the surge in demand. As a result, many buyers are having to deal with unknown suppliers.
I've heard various stories of doctors being conned out of R1 million plus from buying from suppliers who were just fly-by-night and ran with the money. Or doctors who bought like 20,000 masks and had a video of the masks in boxes, whatever it might be. And then when it arrived at their warehouses, only the top three boxes were masks. The rest were all newspapers and they couldn't get a hold of the supplier. So that's one aspect, that can you trust the supplier?
He says the other aspect is the quality of the products.
So you have a lot of Chinese companies as well as local manufacturers who are producing equipment and advertising it as medical equipment. Particularly, it exists around the N95 masks. But the mask that a doctor requires is different from a surgical mask or mask you might see on the street. Those kinds of masks require active filtration. So they need to filter particles coming through that, such that if there's coronavirus in the air, it filters those particular cells or those molecules. And then you have guys who are advertising, yeah, we have this filtration rate, but in fact they don't. So you could have doctors utilizing equipment that isn't actually up to standard.
So how does his website help buyers?
What we're currently doing in regards to verifying suppliers is that they go through quite a rigorous supplier vetting pipeline. And here, what we're doing is suppliers will come onto the website and register. They will say, this is who we are, this is what we sell, etc. And then we'll go ahead and make sure that they have appropriate documentation. So they'll go ahead and submit their company registration documents.
The suppliers also have to provide references from buyers of their medical gear.
We'll go ahead and call those references and ask them, hey, did these guys actually study medical equipment? How was it, et cetera? And then once suppliers have gone through a sufficient process and we're confident that they meet standards such as they're trustworthy, they're then able to list products.
That's not the end of the vetting process.
Now when they're listing products, they go through an additional kind of stage where we're looking at each individual product, making sure that the information there is believable, as well as looking at the various certificates and safety documents associated with that particular product.
Klaas says InSupply was inspired by an American company.
When doing this research in regards to how do we solve the problem of the PPE shortage in the country, I just started doing a lot of research and reading about what other countries were doing. And Project N95 was a particular project that just popped out, and they seem to have incredible traction in regards to the work that they've been doing already within such a short period of time, in essentially doing the same thing of finding verified trusted suppliers and connecting them to verified and trusted buyers in order to make the supply chain of medical procurement more efficient. And they had a lot of information available on the website. I reached out to them, reached out to one of their sister organizations, Get Up PPE, and just started learning a lot from them, collaborating with them in regards to how they were going about this, such as we were able to learn from their mistakes.
Although it hasn't made a profit yet, the InSupply PPE marketplace already has investors with big ambitions.
The particular direction is a little bit of an Alibaba for Africa.
This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
A recent survey of 500 vendors and consumers in Ivory Coast capital Abidjan sought to know more about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting business owners and their customers. According to the survey from local market research team, 81% of vendors say they have experienced a drop in their turnover. Max Smith, a project manager for local, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what the vendors and consumers said they need amid the pandemic.
Now, the second thing on perceptions that was interesting is that 60% of the total respondents believe that the COVID-19 was created in a laboratory. And there are a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding the topic at the moment. And we see a trend, a strong correlation, actually, statistical correlation between the use of social media and the belief in the creation of the COVID-19 in a laboratory or man-made. And there, 81% of students that we interviewed actually shared that belief. And they're the ones who actually have access to smartphones, more prone to using social media, and in many ways also have higher levels of education because they're university students.
But they were the so in terms even of the perceptions, people, even the people with higher access to information were more likely to believe it was made in a lab.
Yeah, actually, they were the ones more likely to believe it than any other socio-professional category, if you may call it that way, that we interviewed. So the youngest people with the university education and access to smartphones were more prone to believe that the COVID-19 was created in a laboratory. And why did we do the study in Abidjan? Of course, with the Conrad and now we're working there, but also because Abidjan and Côte d'Ivoire in general was one of the hardest hit countries and still is in West Africa in terms of total COVID-19 cases. But the fatality rates are hovering a little bit under 2%. And the president recently announced lifting of many restrictions. So people are now allowed to go back to marquees and churches and roam around intra-regionally outside of Abidjan. Abidjan is still closed to the rest of the country because that's where 98% of the cases are. But it was interesting to see one of the country's hardest hit starting to ease restrictions and how that was going to take place.
How does it appear to be taking place? And was there a sense from the community that economic hardship was a greater threat than COVID-19 itself?
The population, you have about 50% of the respondents that were less worried now than they were about 2 weeks ago. That being said, the schools are still closed. In terms of the economic impact, as I mentioned, there's still restrictions on leaving Abidjan, and that's one of the most urgent needs for the vendors that we interviewed. About a quarter of them said that that's a priority for them to regain a little bit economic traction, would be to reopen intra-regional travels, for the government to reopen intra-regional travels. The other main urgency was to decrease the price of gels and masks.
That was Mark Smith, a project manager with the market research company Loka. He was speaking to Ricky Stryker from Dakar. And that's it for this Thursday, June 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.